Dorothy. Rewind. Flashback. The door opens. You take a step forward into Liz's open arms, and her friendly face and welcoming hug is just too much. You tear up as you slump chin first onto her shoulder. She tenses up for a moment, then relaxes. Oh, hell! Let's get you inside. Two steps forward, the door closes, and you find a futon behind you. You crumple slowly backwards on it. Gentle words. Liz fusses around, offering tissues, tea and sympathy. But inevitably, the question you've been dreading arrives. What happened? You open your mouth and find the words have gone missing. I don't know. Liz squats in front of you, takes your right hand in her own, strokes the back of your wrist. She looks intent, focused. You try to speak again, but end up shaking your head. Is it the stalker? She asks. You're appalled at your inarticulacy. I don't know. Didn't think so, not sure now. I've been so stupid. Is this self-pity or anger filling the spring of tears? Which is it? I wasn't telling the truth the other night. When I said Julian was in Moscow. No. She's waiting, hopeful and loyal and just being there. You don't deserve this. He dumped me a couple of months ago, you mutter, not meeting her eyes. I'm not myself right now. What happened? She asks, gently stroking your wrist and watching you with inquisitor's eyes, not accusing, mildly curious. You tell her. Then, when she doesn't explode in a fiery octopus of molten blame, you tell her some more. Being conflicted, wanting a casual pick-up, dinner with Christie, and dessert, and... She listens quietly until you get to the way he chucked you out, and what you thought, the safe word. Did he rape you? She asks, gently enough. But you can feel the tension in her fingertips, rubbing. No, yes, maybe, I'm not sure. You take a deep, ragged breath. It was regrettable sex. I shouldn't have done it, and felt really bad afterwards, kind of sick. I think he might have raped me, if I'd wanted to stop short, but we didn't go there, not at that time. At that time? Her finger motion stops, leaving your wrist limp and open to the air. She's pulled completely away, withdrawn without your noticing. What happened then? You take a deep breath. That's when it got weird. I went back to my room, wedged the door. Then there was a work email. Work? You've been avoiding eye contact up to now, afraid of seeing what your confession is doing to her. But you force yourself to look up. To your surprise, she looks thoughtful. There's no contempt or anger or hatred. She looks almost businesslike. What kind of work? Head office wanted a special type of assessment performing, a sociopathic disorder assessment on a named executive. It was him, Liz. I should have seen it coming before. I mean, I was just stupid. John Christie is a narcissistic psychopath. Who did you say? You flinch. John, Christie. He said he got picked on at school for it, sharing a name with a murderer. No, wait, stop right there. Liz is looking at you with a very odd expression on her face. Would you mind describing him? I mean, how tall is he? How old? How much does he weigh? Now you're on the receiving end of an inquisition. but it's not at all what you expected. Partway through, Liz reaches for a pair of specs and switches them on. She seems to be looking something up. Then she takes them off again, holding them carefully as if afraid they might explode in her hands. She stares at her specs. Jesus, Dorothy! You lick your lips. You don't hate me? Her gaze flickers across you, sweeping you from top to toes. She looks profoundly disturbed, stunned even. Jesus, Dorothy, you're lucky to be alive. But he... You do a double take. Is he a murderer? She won't meet your eyes. I don't know. Hopefully not. But he's certainly a psycho. And what happened to you? Are you sure it wasn't rape? Your mind goes blank. You try to think back to what you were thinking in the run-up to dinner, in the lift up to his room, skulking away with your tail between your legs, showering to forget his touch. Why didn't you use the safe word? Were you afraid he wouldn't stop? Were you enjoying it? It's so confusing. If it's rape, there's a script to follow, isn't there? Yes, but you don't have to worry about that. The hell I don't! Your throat's raw. There were no witnesses. Okay, so suppose I say yes, and you take me round to the station where a trained counsellor talks me through giving a report and taking... You swallow. Samples. And let's suppose your people go and arrest him. At that point it's his word against mine, and you know what his advocate will make of my background. Polyamory still doesn't get equal rights, never mind civil partnerships. I just get dragged through the mud, and to what end? But you've got... Liz jolts to a stop like a Doberman at the end of a choke chain. She's staring at you. Oh, she says softly. Oh, indeed. You reach out your hand towards her. You don't want this, Liz. You don't know what you're opening yourself up for. After a moment, she takes your hand. It wasn't rape, you say, trying to keep any trace of doubt out of your voice for her sake. But I'm really worried about the other thing. Yes, I'd say you should be. Liz is silent for a few seconds. I'd like to take a statement, though, all the same. What? But I told you it wasn't non-consensual. Not about the sex, about the appraisal. You shiver. I'd rather not, if you don't mind. She sits down beside you on the futon. It's about Christie. He's a person of interest in another investigation. We want to question him in relation to a violent crime. I can't tell you about it right now, but what you've told me, it's really important. My colleagues, they need to know about this. Do you mind if I file at least a contact report? You sniff, then rub a hand across your eyes. There's no mascara or eyeliner, luckily. You stripped before you showered. You're going to insist, aren't you? She manages a weak smile. You said it. I didn't. Oh, hell. You struggle to sit up. Just, do you mind if I stay overnight? I can't face that room. You can stay, she says neutrally. I'll take the futon. She pulls her police specs on again, then pauses, one finger hovering over the power button. I still love you, you know. I just wish things weren't so messy. Then she pushes the button. Liz, Project Athena. People laugh when they hear the phrase artificial intelligence these days. McDonald is on a roll. But it's not funny. We've come a long way since the 1950s. There's a joke in the field. If we know how to do it, it's not intelligence. Playing checkers or chess or solving mathematical theorems, image recognition, speech recognition, handwriting recognition, diagnosing an illness, driving a car through traffic, operating an organic chemistry lab to synthesize new compounds. These were all thought to be aspects of intelligence back in the day, but now they're things you can buy through an app store or on lease purchase from Toyota. What people think of when you say artificial intelligence is basically stuff they've glommed onto via the media. HAL 9000, or Neuromancer, artificial consciousness. But consciousness, we know how that shit works these days via analytical cognitive neurobiology and synthetic neurocomputing. And it's not very interesting. We can't do stuff with it. Worst case, suppose I were to sit down with my colleagues and we come up with a traditional brain-in-a-box type AI, shades of HAL 9000. What then? Firstly, it opens a huge can of ethical worms. Once you turn it on, does turning it off again qualify as murder? What about software updates, bug fixes even? Secondly, it's not very useful. Even if you cut the Gordian knot and declare that because it's a machine, it's a slave, you can't make it do anything useful. Not unless you've built in some way of punishing it, in which case we're off into the ethical minefield on a pogo stick tour. Human consciousness isn't optimized for anything, except maybe helping feral hominids survive in the wild. So we're not very interested in reinventing human consciousness in a box. What gets the research grants flowing is applications, and that's what Athena is all about. You're listening to his lecture in slack-jawed near comprehension because of the sheer novelty of it all. One of the crushing burdens of police work is how inanely stupid most of the shit you get to deal with is. Idiot children who think, "The dog ate my homework," is a decent excuse, even though they knew you were watching when they stuck it down the back of their trousers. MacDonald is, well, he's not waiting while you take notes, for sure. Luckily, your specs are life-logging everything to the evidence servers back at HQ, and Kamal's also on the ball. But even so, MacDonald's whistle-stop tour of the frontiers of science is close to doing your head in. Then the aforementioned Eurocop speaks up.
"That is very interesting, Doctor, but can I ask you for a moment?"
Kamal leans forward.
"What do you think of the singularity?"
MacDonald stares at him for a moment as if he can't believe what he's being asked. "The what?" you begin to say, just as his shoulders begin to shake. It takes you a second to realize he's laughing. "You'll have to excuse me," he says wheezily, wiping the back of his hand across his eyes. "I haven't been asked that one in years." Your sidelong glance at Kamal doesn't illuminate this remark. Kamal looks as baffled as you feel.
"I, for one, welcome our new superintelligent AI overlords,"
MacDonald declaims, and then he's off again. "What's so funny?" you ask.
"Oh, hell!"
MacDonald waves a hand in the air and a tag pops up in your specs.
"Let me give you the dog and pony show."
You accept it. His office dissolves into classic cyberspace noir, all black leather and decaying corrugated asbestos roofing, with a steady drip, drip, drip of condensation. Blade Runner City, Matrixville. Remember when you used to change your computer every year or so, and the new one was cheaper and much faster than the old one? A graph appears in the moisture-bleeding wall behind him, pastel arcs zooming upward in an exponential plot of MIPS over dollar against time, the curve suddenly flattening out a few years before the present. Folks back then, he points to the steepest part of the upward curve, extrapolated a little too far. Firstly, they grabbed the AI bull by the horns and assumed that if heavier-than-air flight was possible at all, then the artificial seagull would ipso facto resemble a biological one, behaviorally. Then they assumed it could bootstrap itself onto progressively faster hardware or better optimized software, refining itself. A window appears in the wall beside you. Turning, you see a nightmare cityscape, wrecked buildings festering beneath a ceiling of churning, fulvous clouds. Insectile robots pick their way across grey rubble spills. Another graph slides across the end times diorama, this one speculative. Intelligence in human equivalence against time. Like the first graph, it's an exponential. Doesn't work, of course. There isn't enough headroom left for exponential amplification, and in any case, nobody needs it. Religious fervour about the rapture of the nerds aside, there are no shortcuts. Actual artificial intelligence applications resemble us about the way an Airbus resembles a seagull. And just like airliners have flaps and rudders and seagulls don't, one of the standard features of general cognitive engines is that they're all hardwired for mirrored self-misidentification. That is, they all project the seat of their identity onto you or some other human being and identify your desires as their own impulses. That standard operating precaution number one. Nobody wants to be confronted by a psychotic brain in a box. What we really want is identity amplification. Secondly, Kamal interrupts again. You do a double take. In this corner of the academic metaverse, he's come over all sinister in a black and silver suit with peaked forage cap, mirrored aviator shades.
Stop right there, please. You're implying that this field is mature? That is, that you routinely do this sort of thing?
MacDonald blinks rapidly. Didn't you know? You take a deep breath. We're just cops. Nobody tells us anything. Humour us. General cognitive engines are we talking about? Project Athena, is that one?
Loosely, yes.
He rubs at his face, an expression of profound bafflement wrinkling his brows.
Athena is one of a family of research-oriented identity amplification engines that have been developed over the past few years. It's not all academic. For example, T.R. Mithras, Junkbot D, and Worm Nerveburn 10143 are out there now. They're malware AI engines. The Junkbot family are distributed identity simulators used for harvesting trust, while Nerveburn, we're not entirely sure, but it seems to be a sandboxed virtual brain simulator running on a botnet, possibly a botched attempt at premature mind uploading. He rubs his face again. Athena is a bit different. We're an authorized botnet. That is, we're legal. Students at participating institutions are required to sign an EULA that permits us to run a VM instance on their pad or laptop, strictly for research in distributed computing. There's also a distributed screensaver project for volunteers. Athena's our research platform in moral metacognition.
Metacognition?
Loosely, it means we're in consciousness studies. More prosaically, we're in the business of telling spam from ham.
He shrugs apologetically.
Big contracts from telcos who want to cut down on the junk traffic. It pays our grants. The spam bots have been getting disturbingly convincing. Last month, there was a report of a spearfishing worm that was hiring call girls to role-play the pickups the worm had primed its targets to expect. Some of them are getting very sophisticated, using multiple contact probes to simulate an entire social network. Big ones, hundreds or thousands of members with convincing interactions, e-commerce, fake phone conversations, the whole lot, in front of the victim. Bluntly, we're only human. We can't tell the difference between a spam bot and a real human being anymore without face-to-face contact. So we need identity amplification to keep up. The Athena Research Group is working on the spam filtering problem by running a huge distributed metacognition app that's intended to pick holes in the spammers' fake social networks.
MacDonald magics up a big diagram in place of the graphs. It looks like a tattered spiderweb.
Here's a typical social network. Each node is a person. They've got a lot of local connections and a handful of long-range ones. Thin strands snake across the web, linking distant intersections. Zoom in on one of the nodes, and we have a bunch of different networks. Their email, chat, phone calls, online purchases. A slew of different spiderwebs, cerise and cyan and magenta, all appear centred on a single point. They're all subtly different in shape. Spam bots usually get their networks wrong, too regular, not noisy enough. And we can deduce other information by looking at the networks, of course. You know, the old one about checking the phone bills for signs that your partner's having an affair, right? There are other, more subtle signs of, well, call it potential criminality. Odds are, before your partner snuck off for some illicit nookie, there was a warm-up period, lots of chatter with characteristic weighted phrases. We're human. We talk in clichés the whole time, framing the narrative of our lives, or take some of the commoner personality disorders. Pre-Athena, we had diagnostic tools that could diagnose schizophrenia from a sample of email messages with eerie accuracy. Network analysis lets us learn a lot about people. Network injection lets us steer people. Subject to ethics oversight, I hasten to add. Frankly, the possibilities are endless and a bit frightening.
Can you give me an example of what you mean by steering people?
Kamal nudges.
MacDonald's chair squeals as he leans back. Okay, let's talk hypotheticals. Suppose I'm wearing a black hat and I want to fuck someone up and I've paid for a command channel to Junkbot D. First, I build a map of their social connections. Then I have Junkbot establish a bunch of sock puppets and do a friend-of-friend approach via their main social networks. Build up connections until they see the sock puppets' friend requests, see lots of friends in common, and accept the invite. Junkbot then engages them in several conversation scripts in parallel. A linear chat-up rarely works. People are too suspicious these days. But you can game them. Set up an artificial reality game, if you like, built around your victim's world, with a bunch of sock puppets who are there to sucker them into the drama. Finally, you use the client-side toolkit to hire some proxies. Ned's in search of the price of a pint, who'll hand your target a package and leg it 5 minutes ahead of your colleagues, who have received an anonymous tip-off that the quiet guy living at number 76 is a nonce. Kamal is rapt, listening intently. He nods, perhaps once every 10 seconds. MacDonald has got him on a string with his spiel. You look back at MacDonald. "You wouldn't dream of doing that," you say. MacDonald grins and nods. "Indeed not. Morality aside, it's stupid small-scale shit. What'd be the point?" You peg him then. He's not your typical Aspie hacker, and he's not a regular impulse control case. MacDonald's the other rare kind, the sort of potential offender who does a cold-blooded risk-benefit calculation and refrains from action, not because it's wrong, but because the trade-off isn't right. You won't be seeing him in the daily arrest log any time soon, because he kens well the opportunity cost of a decade in prison. It'd take a bottom line denominated in millions to lure him off the straight and narrow, but if he sees such a payoff... "What do you use Athena for?" you ask bluntly. "Right now we're tracing spammers. Athena can scope out the fake networks. It can also tell us who's running them." There's something about MacDonald's body language that puts you on red alert. Something evasive. "Athena then probes the spammers to determine whether they're human or sock puppet. We're working on active countermeasures, but that's not greenlit yet. I gather there's a working group talking to some staff at the Ministry of Justice about it, but..." "What kind of active countermeasures?" "Spoiler stuff, but more active than usual, using their own tools against them. You know, it's an international problem. Crossing lines of jurisdiction. A lot of them live in countries that aren't signatory to or don't enforce anti-net crime treaties. So we're examining a number of tactics that need to be approved by a court order before we could use them. So far it's just theoretical, but reverse-fishing the spammers to grab their control channels and shut down the botnets. Fucking with their phishing payloads to make them expose their real identity so you folks can arrest them. Stealing their banking credentials and applying civil forfeiture protocols. Using their ID protocols to fuck with their personal lives. Hate mail to the mother-in-law, that kind of thing. Having their computer report itself as stolen. In an extreme instance, ask the USAF to send a drone to zap them.
You glance down and try to look as if you're making notes so that he can't see your face. One by one, the alarm bells are going off inside your head. But you haven't done any of this yet.
No. But Athena is an international effort.
MacDonald leans forward on his elbows, fingers laced before him.
We are just academic researchers. We're trying to find a way to, shall we say, enforce communal standards without turning the corner and ending up with a panopticon singularity, ubiquitous maximal law enforcement by software. Nobody wants that. So we're looking for something more humane. Crime prevention by automated social pressure rather than crime prosecution by AI. But once you get into that territory, people don't all agree on what constitutes crime or moral behaviour. Some of our associate members live in jurisdictions where there are melted stovepipes between academia and government or intelligence, and I cannot vouch for what those third parties might do with our work.
Anwar. Bluebeard.
As soon as you open the front door, you know something's not right. Honey, I'm home. It's like that inevitable, deterministic scene in every horror video you've ever lost 2 hours of your life to. The dawning sense of wrongness, of a life unhinged. From the subtle absence of expected sounds to the different, unwelcome noise from upstairs in the bedroom, all is out of order. Hello? You call up the stairwell. There's no reply, but you hear footsteps like a herd of baby elephants on the landing. Angry footsteps. Your stomach clenches. They are Bibi's angry footsteps, and now you know what's wrong. All that remains is to find out why. You tiptoe past an obstruction in the hall and look up the stairs. Is everything all right? You call. There's a muffled thud, a wail of pain, and some most unladylike swearing. Then there's another thud, louder. Bibi hauls into view on the landing, leaning to one side, the big yellow suitcase dragging at the ends of her arms like a boat anchor. Her glare of effort silences you as she levers it onto the top stair tread. It must be full to be so heavy. The suitcase is a 100-litre monster, sized for that month-long family excursion to Lahore that never came. Ever since, it's lurked under Nassim's bed like a bright plastic chrysalis from which someday a holiday will hatch. It's nearly bigger than Bibi, and for a heart-stopping moment, you think she's going to be crushed by it. But no, it rocks heavily on the stair, then she's behind it, gripping it by the toe handle and leaning backwards as she lowers it towards you like a juggernaut of wrath. Finally, it hits the hall carpet and sits there, and Bibi pushes it past you, breathing heavily. "What are you doing?" you ask.
"What does it look as if I'm doing?"
There's an odd lilting note in her voice, almost devil-may-care. Is it your mother?
No, Anwar, it's you.
I don't. You're about to say understand, but for a cursed moment your tongue freezes. Where are the children? She pushes the heavy bag past you, forcing you to step back against the wall. She's on the other side of it, using it as a shield.
What's in the bucket?
She asks tensely.
Where did you get that suitcase?
She's been up the ladder.
Oh, shit.
I can explain. It's work. A man from head office, from the foreign office. He's coming to stay just for a couple of nights.
Shut up, Anwar.
You focus on her nostrils, on the tip of her nose. They're flared wide as if she smells something awful, something vile. She's shaking slightly. Fear? Anger? You've always found it hard to read, Bibi. The long silences, the elliptical comments, the woman's expectation of insight, as if you're expected to read and pass the invisible code written on the inside of her eyelids. Contempt? What's wrong, you ask? I'm leaving, she says, as calmly as if announcing she was going to work. What? Well, you stand, perplexed, back up against the wall. She shoves the suitcase past you to stand beside the smaller bag that obstructs the hallway. When are you coming back? You ask, feeling lost. She grabs the smaller bag by the handle. That's up to you. She drags it up to the open front door, then stops, straightens up, and glares at you. Get rid of that stuff. Get help. Then you can email me. But what? What stuff? None of this makes sense. I don't understand. No, you don't. Her contempt is withering. I've put up with a lot of not understanding from you over the years. Not understanding what it is about obeying the law, Anwar. Not understanding that you're going to get caught if you carry on. And I've been giving you a lot of not understanding in return. Not understanding about the pubs and the late nights. Not understanding about your boyfriends and the condoms. I could even manage to not understand your brewing experiment in the attic or the dodgy business deals. But the other thing, I can't not understand that. Promise me you'll get help and we can talk. Chat. I am. I won't tell the police. Her shoulders are shaking. But if I catch you near the kids, I'll tell everyone. She turns away. Tell everyone what? But you're talking to a receding back, hunched under the weight of too much baggage. You blink against the daylight, mouth hanging open, unable to grasp what's happening. There's a sour taste in your mouth and a ringing in your ears and a terrible tension in your head. The injustice of it all. If you were a real man of your father's generation, you'd chase after her and drag her back and thrash her soundly. If you were a real man of your father's generation, she'd call social services on you. Where's the honour in this? What does she think you've done to be so offended? The bucket, the suitcase, oh God! The front door slams closed behind you as you scamper for the suitcase, as if all the hounds of hell are chasing you. She's been upstairs, and it's not the bucket. You pull down the loft ladder and scramble up it, gasping for breath, surface in the attic like a mole in a lawn suddenly come face to face with a roller. The bucket is where you left it, but Peter Manuel's suitcase sits open on the floor in the middle of the puddle of daylight admitted by the dormer window. Bibi must have forced the lock, you realise. A small, pale-skinned arm rests just over the zippered rim, as if a wee bairn is sleeping inside. Then the arm twitches, flailing for a grip. A little girl, about 3 years younger than Farida, sits up in the suitcase. Blonde tousled hair and button nose, blue eyes and puppy fat. But there's something wrong with her. Her face is expressionless and paralysed, her mouth gaping so wide you think for a horrid moment that her jaw is dislocated. Her skin doesn't seem to fit properly. And she's naked. Naked and in a suitcase. Then she looks at you with undead eyes and speaks without moving her mouth. Will you fuck me, Daddy? I want you. I've been so lonely without you.
Liz. Dominoes fall.
You don't normally come out of an interview with a material witness blinking at the light and wondering which way up your world goes. Twice in 24 hours is something of a personal record. Nevertheless, you take one look at Kamal's face and feel a twinge of recognition. You step aside for a stranger entering the building as the grimy glass door swings shut behind you, distracted by the need to marshal your thoughts. "Did you get anything out of that?" you ask. Kamal shakes his head, not in negation, but in weary acknowledgement.
"The future is here today, unevenly distributed," he misquotes. "I do not think the doctor is a murderer. Not a knowing one, of course."
You keep your thoughts to yourself for a moment as you look around for the car. It's missing. Hold on. You ping the front desk back at head office. Where's our ride? Sniffy McSluggard takes her own sweet time getting back to you.
CID told it was needed elsewhere, Inspector. You'll be wanting to charge for a bus ride.
Which is just bloody typical. Come on, you tell Kamal, and head down Buccleuch Street towards the shortcut through to South Clark Street. What makes you think the doctor's in the clear?
I do not think he's innocent, Kamal admits. His speech stress is uneven. He hides something, yes. And the spam connection, and the cognitive engine, the use of distributed networks, that is significant. But I don't think he's a killer.
Why not, you needle?
He is a coward.
Kamal pauses next to a rack of council recycling bins.
That is a technical term, he adds. He's a thinking man and an overplanner. He anticipates hazards before they emerge and avoids them. Risk averse.
That's how I pegged him, you aver. So why did Dodgy Dickie want you to interview him? I think we should do some more digging. If someone's using Athena to locate targets, that would fit. You trail off. There's that nagging sense of déjà vu. You know Dr. MacDonald from somewhere, you're sure of it. One or other of the pubs and bars in the Pink Triangle. Or a pride march in years past, when you were managing the Lothian and Borders booth. That's as may be, but it's not relevant to the case in hand. Let's find out who he talks to. Let's see what Moxie can find out about his connections. Back on South Clark Street, you hijack a microbus with the aid of your company debit card and bid handsomely to divert it halfway to Dean Village. There's some jerk on the top deck who counterbids, and it ends up ramping up to €20. But fuck it. Two DIs on a murder investigation. Doc will square it for you. You walk the last stretch and are back at HQ by 11. The MacDonald interview has preceded you. Uploaded in real time, it made it into the Babylon Intel feed and promptly bamboozled everyone on the team who was paying attention. As you walk through the shielded doors, a blizzard of virtual post-it notes descends on you, terminating in a terse, "See me," signed DCI McLeish. It's like being back in grammar school again. You give Kamal the eyeball. Got to run. Make yourself at home in ICIU. You barely walk through the door to D31 before Dickie is on your case. Face like thunder, beetling brows, he rushes you.
This way, he growls, striding towards a confessional cubicle. Beige fabric walls, anti-sound damper poised overhead like a metal mantis. He barely waits to get into the cone of silence before he launches on you.
I don't know what you fucking think you're doing, Kavanaugh, snooping around on your off shift and sticking your nose in.
Hey, what the fuck are you?
No, don't you start. I should take this up the chain right now.
You're a loose cannon. This report on the street, woman, is the final straw.
You snap. Fuck off.
What?
His expression is a picture in peach, slowly ripening towards plum. You got about 5 seconds before he really explodes, so you go for the throat.
She came to me, sir. Because, you know, outside of work, I have this thing called a life, and Dorothy is one of my friends. Friends, Dickie, you've heard of them. Jesus fucking Christ, have you never had a friend come to you with a question about the law? Come on, tell me. Have you? I've never had a so-called friend cough a fucking POI in a murder investigation in my lap. Well, neither have I, but there's always a first time. And I bet you've never had a girlfriend cough to a date-rape situation either, have you? But that's what friends are for. The R word gets his attention. Rape, did you say? You make a cutting gesture. I didn't think there was a case to answer, or I'd have had her down the clinic before her feet touched the floor. Questionable sex, with a side order of sociopathic manipulation involved. Her word against his, no drugs or threats of violence. It gets murky fast. But no, sir, the reason I filed the report was this John Christie sock puppet is in play, and I figured you might want to talk to him. About what he was doing visiting our friend, Mr. Blair. You don't add, instead of adding 2 plus 2 to make 16.7 and threatening me with a disciplinary. That's understood, but his expression begins to droop from bullish to sheepish, and the choleric colour is fading. Jesus, Liz! You've won, you see, but you're still pissed off at him for losing his rag in the first place. Probably best to let him know about it, both barrels and the face. Dickie's not terribly perceptive when it comes to subtleties of interpersonal relations. We are on the same team, sir. I really do not appreciate this hard-on you've got for me. I'm attempting to discharge my duty as efficiently as possible, and you keep dumping on me. When I stumbled over a lead by pure chance, I sent it your way because that's the right thing to do. I don't expect to catch shit by return of email. If you'd be happier with me off the case, then just say so. I've got a patch of my own to cultivate, but some professional courtesy would be appreciated around here. The red spots on his cheeks come back, but he visibly bites his lip and nods. It's just a quiver of acknowledgement, but it's the real thing. Suck it up, asshole. To his credit, he nods again. It would seem that I owe someone an apology, he admits. Don't be too fast with that. You could poke somebody's eye out. You confine your response to a minutely calculated nod. About Dr. MacDonald? No, says Dickie, and something about his turn alerts you, puts you on notice that he's forgotten for a moment that he hates you. No? Summat you said. He frowns frumiously, an expression that comes easily to the front of his wrinkled noggin. Stumbled over a lead by pure chance, so you say. Do you really think that's plausible? What are you implying? Your hackles are still raised. I'm not implying anything about you. What I'm saying is, it's a very convenient coincidence. And if there's one thing you can, I dinna trust, it's coincidences. And there's too goddamn many of them in this aye mess. You stop. Dr. MacDonald. His whole social network analysis thing. Dickie fixes you with one cold blue eye and nods slowly beneath the cone of silence. You begin to come down from the adrenaline spike of career-terminating rage when you arrive back at the door to the ICIU. Inside, all is as it should be. The ever-rotating pool of uniformed porn monkeys are whining for release from the vomitorium. Moxie is forted up in the second office behind a stack of giant monitors and discarded munchie boxes, and Kamal is propping up the wall behind him, looking bored behind his shades. "Hey, Skipper!" Moxie leers at you over a browser full of... You look away quickly. What can I do you for? Dr. Adam MacDonald, Ed Uni, CS Department. What have we got on him? How deep do you want to go? Your ferret is bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Moxie likes nothing better than a good chase. Public sources first? Nothing I have to sign for at this time. Well, Moxie twitches his fingers at a couple of tabs. It's funny you ask that, Skipper. He's got an article on Wiki People, you know. And the social network's What's Not Friends Locked. A couple of single sign-ons will vouch for him, and he posts in chat rooms all over the place. He pulls a face. Nothing saucy, well, nothing much. He's divorced, one ex-husband. He's heterosexually challenged and hangs out in the usual places. Kamal is head down over a pad, evidently brainstorming something. You can see lots of mind map bubbles floating in an ochre soup of murky possibilities. Okay, let me authorize a trawl of cop space links under Babylon's authority. You don't have the authority to pull up random citizens' cop space records on your own, but MacDonald's on Babylon's radar as a POI, and you're on team as an inspector, so your signing authority will cover it. You lean over Mox's terminal and stick your thumbprint on the reader, as required. It's very fast and streamlined these days. The hierarchical delegation of surveillance authority under RIPA statutes, police intelligence access via social network. Let's see who the good doctor has been talking to lately. Kamal catches your eye. While Moxie is busy, you follow him outside into the bright sunlight. The drive is occupied. Someone's parked a bunch of the force's riot barrier trailers there, lined up as if there's an upcoming derby. What is it? You ask.
Your boss must really hate you.
To your surprise, he pulls out a pack of cigarettes and glances around.
Do you mind?
You shake your head. Yes, he does. 5 years ago I was in line for the job he's in now, and he knows it. I'm the skeleton in his closet. Lothian and Borders is officially a non-smoking force, but Kamal's just visiting and you're outside and more than 10 meters from a doorway. Is that legal? His cheek twitches in something like a smile.
I have given up giving up.
You step sideways to stand upwind of him. Any thoughts? He gets the thing lit and inhales deeply, frowning. After he lets the smoke out, the set of his shoulders relaxes somewhat.
I've been reading this morning's reports. More fatalities. One of them is a computer scientist in Boston. The usual methodology applies. A misdirected package. This man, though, was a full professor, not a spammer. He listed Project Athena as one of his research areas.
You think that's why Ops sent us to see MacDonald?
I think so.
He nods, then sucks at the cancer stick again.
Also,
he shrugs tiredly.
The information crimes angle.
You get that hint instantly. ICIU is the red-headed stepchild of CID and IT support, the spotty teenager with the suspect habits whose bedroom nobody willingly cleans for fear of what they'll find under the bed. It's the same everywhere. Most police work boils down to minimizing the impact on society of stupidity. Of the remainder, the overwhelming majority is about malice and deliberate evil, but it's still almost all stupid. Smart cops hate smart crimes because they take ages to nail down, and in the meantime, your cleanup metrics tank. And the crime here, assuming there's anyone to charge with it, is so high concept that it's making your nose bleed. What kind of scenario do you think we're looking at? Smoke trickles from his nostrils.
We have bodies linked in life by a social network, linked in dying by weird coincidences. We have software for scanning social networks and making deductions about the people in them. We have researchers discussing active countermeasures. The question that remains is, did a human being order the software that is conscious to start taking such measures, or is it an accident?
Different charges either way. He stubs the cigarette out on the sole of one shoe and pockets the butt, staring at you. For your part, you stare at the roofline of the intelligence building, feeling numb. If someone gave the order, well, there's your mens rea and a tidy wrap-up. If nobody did so, then we're into murkier waters. Negligent homicide, maybe.
And the software?
Kamal raises an eyebrow.
If it's conscious.
Fuck the software. You struggle to keep your voice under control. I know what you're going to say, and it doesn't wash. The law's about 50 years behind the times here, but nobody's going to shed any tears for a killer robot. If it went off on its lonesome, there's going to be such a shitstorm of new legislation coming down the pipe. You stop. Oh, you say. Coincidences. And it's a good thing you're not a smoker like Kamal, because the blinding flash of insight when Dickie's time bomb detonates is so dazzling that you'd have dropped your fag. And it's a 50 euro fine for littering under the cameras hereabouts. Lay out the clues like a chain of dominoes. Mikey Blair, killed by a drug interaction between his spiked enema fluid and his protease inhibitor prescription. That's a coincidence, isn't it? John Christie, whoever he really is, walking in on the crime scene. Let's call that another coincidence and see where it runs. Lots more killings, all coincidentally contrived, like the Mohammed case. Electrocuted by a homicidal vacuum cleaner robot, or the German guy burned to a crisp by his sunbed. Coincidence as a modus operandi. A sequence of little nudges that build to a fatal payoff. If one fatal accident fails to materialize, what are the odds that a bunch of other lethal contingencies lie in the target's future? Now consider further. John Christie walks into your life by way of Dorothy's hotel. She's been booked in there by her employers. He, you shy away from thinking about this too hard, manipulates her. Then she gets a request for an ethics review. If that's an accident, you'll eat your warrant card. But what if Dorothy was a channel to get to you? Specifically to draw your attention to John Christie, because your chain of dominoes terminates in confusion, and you're out of time.